15th August 1947, India celebrated freedom, but the maps were bleeding. Borders were not drawn, they were slashed. 1 million dead, 10 million displaced. The trauma still lingers, shaping generations. Lines drawn in blood. Homes lost, hearts torn apart. The wound that still bleeds. He's here to confront the truth head on. How are you?
How are you? Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. A master at turning the page on colonial myths and rewriting history, Dr. Shashi Tharoor. Our episode today is on partition.
Yes.
So I'm assuming it's going to get emotional. In the backdrop of the recent India-Pakistan tensions, or as you call it, the 88-hour-long war, do you think it's hard not to connect the dots back to partition?
Absolutely. In fact, everything to do with India-Pakistan problems since 1947 can be traced to that disaster. It was, unfortunately, when you look back on the history of India, the single greatest disservice and the single greatest accomplishment of the British was the creation of this perpetual conflict. It really is an awful story. In every particular, we had spoken about the whole divide and rule policy of the British, but its tragic culmination meant that the British could divide, but they could no longer rule. And the result was this horrendous, horrendous crisis, which never seems to show any sign of ending. It's like this wound that will never heal.
On Sky News, a defense expert said that Mountbatten messed up partition big time and that there's so much tension in the region today because of that. Do you think the rushed exit made things worse?
Everything. I mean, the rushed exit was part of the problem. It was certainly a significant part of the problem. But the fundamental problem was the fact that the British had created a technique that made it easier for them to rule, namely divide and rule, by creating this very separate consciousness for the Muslim community and encouraging it, fomenting it, financing it, and all of that, enabling it particularly then and finally in the last few years, until it got to a point where it became impossible to continue to rule a united India. And then they just scuttled and left. The first Brexit was this disastrous departure of 1947, and it was done in great haste. In fact, the British had actually announced they would depart India by June 1948. The initial sort of cabinet mission plan was somewhat unworkable because it basically envisaged groups of provinces with Muslim majority provinces in one category and Hindu majority provinces in another category and princely states in a third category. And each group would have had the right to secede after 10 years. It would have been a big mess and not at all a workable system. So nobody really liked that. Then came 1947 when Mountbatten arrived to replace Lord Wavell, the last sort of reasonable viceroy. And Mountbatten came in full of self-importance. He'd been the supreme Allied commander of the Second World War. On the 15th of August, 1945, he had accepted the surrender of the Japanese forces in Southeast Asia. So he kind of said, I'm going to get this done. And he said, why wait till June 48? The anniversary of my big triumph is a good day, 15th August 1947. And so suddenly, what could have been done by June 1948 got truncated, and he did the whole thing in a matter of months. Now, that's bad enough, his haste. Now, he argues that the haste was necessary because the country was falling apart. Jinnah had declared Direct Action Day, you remember, in 1946 in August, where there were massacres, horrendous massacres in Calcutta. The British called them the Great Calcutta Killings, but which they proved unable to stop. So the feeling was, if the Muslims didn't get their own country, there would be more killing, more butchery, and so on. Ironically, as we all know with hindsight, poor Jinnah was actually dying. And had the original plan of 1948 remained, the most obdurate advocate of partition might not even have been around. A good Lord might have taken him by then. But he was also in a hurry. Mountbatten was in a hurry. The Indian Congress leaders didn't want partition, particularly Mahatma Gandhi was stoutly resistant to it till the very end. But even people like Nehru and Patel, who had felt that India should be kept united, finally were just exhausted by all of this and said, let's give in, better to rule what remains of the country than to continually suffer this kind of division. And there is a further reason for this. In 1946, an interim government had been formed by Lord Wavell, an interim government to rule India, which included both the Congress and the Muslim League. But the Muslim League used the interim government to demonstrate that they would not cooperate with the Congress. So they absolutely refused to approve any file submitted by a Congress minister to their ministries. The finance minister of the government was Liaquat Ali of the Muslim League. He basically continually blocked the budget. The League's non-cooperation meant that the Congress minister said, how can we run a country with these people? They clearly will not cooperate. And that lesson also convinced the Congress that we may as well give in to the idea of partition.
People both online and offline are confused, Shashi. Does partition continue to shape our politics, our identity, and also our diplomatic relationships today?
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, between the two countries, definitely. Because partition created a schism that will not heal. In a civilization that had been won for thousands of years, suddenly a whole new country was born with hostility and bristling hostility on a daily basis, reinforced by an ideology that claims that Hindus and Muslims can never live together and they're separate nations and so on. Now, there are multiple problems coming from this. First, Pakistan has this notion of the unfinished business of partition. What is the unfinished business for them? It is Kashmir, because Kashmir is a Muslim-majority state contiguous with Pakistan, but not in Pakistan. They want it. And they want it, and they're prepared to kill, and they're prepared to commit terrorist acts, and they're prepared to go to war to get it. India says, you're not going to get it. So we've had wars in 1948, in 1965. Yes, in 71, the war was more about Bangladesh. In 1999, over Kargil. And now the most recent 88-day tragedy. And we've had 36 years of terrorist attacks all over this so-called unfinished business. So this has been a very, very major, prolonged legacy from the Pakistani chip-on-the-shoulder point of view. Secondly, India had really never accepted the logic of partition. India did not agree that Hindus and Muslims could not live together. On the contrary, India said to the Muslims of India, those who've chosen to stay on, you're Indians, you have all the rights of every other Indian. So the result was you had, on the one hand, a bigoted Islamist state on one side, and you had a secular pluralist state on the other. The two ideas are incompatible. Every time a Muslim came to prominence in India, President of India, Chief Justice of India, General of the Army, all of these things, major movie stars, cricket captains, whatever, it was a standing rebuke of the very Pakistani idea. If a Muslim could achieve all this in India, then why did Pakistan need to be created? That too was a constant irritant to them. They wanted to keep attacking this. For them, creating, highlighting, and fomenting Hindu-Muslim division in India was a very important thing, which is why as recently as 2025, you have this bigoted Islamist general who commands the Pakistani army, a man called General Asif Munir, making a speech that could have been made by Jinnah in 1947, saying Hindus and Muslims cannot live together. You know, you keep thinking, my God, if only those 10 years had gone differently, what a different subcontinent we would have had, what a different country we'd be. You know, the kind of sort of world leadership that China is truly enjoying today might have been ours, but we have been held back by decades of hostility, bitterness, unproductive military expenditure, futile wars, terrorism, all because of partition.
Need to mention Radcliffe here, who never visited India, but was given 5 weeks, 5 weeks to draw the border and split the whole subcontinent. Now, do you think the total disconnect with the land and its people basically is the big cause of this chaos.
It's a detail. I mean, the British, of course, had the attitude that somebody who knew India would have their own biases, they'd have their own friendships, they'd have their own opinions. So better to have somebody who knew nothing. And therefore, the detachment that Ratcliffe brought to his task was supposed to be a virtue, number one. Number two, Ratcliffe had never visited India, but he actually did the job in India. He was brought to Delhi and parked in a bungalow on the Viceregal Estate, the Rashtrapati Bhavan Gardens of today. Now, the problem there is that there was not enough time, given the deadline of August 15, for him to actually go to either Punjab or Bengal. So he literally did the work only by looking at maps. And so you had this ridiculous series of lines, in many cases, cutting villages in half, in one notorious case, cutting a house in half, because he didn't realize there was a house there, or how much detail. There were no satellites and you know, satellite photographs in those days. So the line was drawn without very much regard for everything, but what he had was the census figures of 1931. There was no census in 41. So he had figures that were 15 years old. He knew many of the things would be out of date. He knew that all he had was a map, and he was doing the rest by guesswork and intelligence. He was supposed to be a very brilliant man, so he did it that way. Ratcliffe, I must say, when he did his award, he himself said that he should never come back to India because if somebody or the other would shoot him. And he never did come back to India. He had 5 weeks in India sitting in the Rashtrapati Bhavan in the Viceregal Estate and dividing through his lines homes, hearts, history, all being divided. Lines then meant lives, because once the lines were published, lives were lost as people desperately scrambled to get to the right side of the line. And so Hindus and Sikhs thought, for example, that certain places would remain in India. Suddenly they discovered after Independence Day is when the map was published that their homes had suddenly become a foreign country. They had to scramble to leave. The trains were jam-packed with people trying to get out. People were butchering people in their homes to force them to leave. There was murder and mayhem happening. There were examples of entire train loads of corpses arriving on the other side, because literally people would climb on the trains and kill everybody because they knew everybody leaving was not from their religion. It was just one of those human tragedies. At least a million people lost their lives, and some 13 to 17 million were displaced. It really was a human tragedy that the world cannot imagine or hadn't seen before or since.
There's a powerful poem by W.H. Auden about, yes, Ratcliffe's shock.
Oh, God, yes, I know it well.
Have you had a chance to?
Yes, I know this poem. I know this poem rather well. Shut up in a lonely mansion with police night and day, patrolling the gardens to keep assassins away, he got down to work to the task of settling the fate of millions. The maps at his disposal were out of date, and the census returns almost certainly incorrect. But there was no time to check them, no time to inspect contested areas. The weather was frightfully hot, and a bout of dysentery kept him constantly on the trot. But in 7 weeks it was done. The frontiers decided, a continent, for better or worse, divided. It's so sad. I mean, Auden was a brilliant poet. There's a little more to the poem than that, but the worst thing about it was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's a line in this poem about how he tells his club, you know, that he'll never go back, because if he does, he'll be shot. I think that's also the poem. I mean, it's just the whole situation is unforgivable. I believe some years later, the BBC or somebody tried to interview him. There's a sort of poignant story about how much he regretted his role. In fact, one interesting detail is, at least he was a man of principle, he was so ashamed of what he had done that he refused to accept his salary. The British had offered him a very generous salary for this work, and he, being a lawyer, lawyers always charge high fees, he said, I can't take the money. What I've done is too much of a sin to bear. And he never took the salary.
And I'll come to Churchill now, who wasn't exactly pro-India. He also criticized the British government for rushing India's exit. He warned that it was too chaotic without a proper plan. What do you think were Churchill's concerns, really?
He didn't want India to be given freedom at all. And he made these ridiculous speeches saying that the country will be full of freeloaders and freebooters and bandits and it'll fall to rack and ruin and all this nonsense. That was Churchill. There was this basic racist thing. And there was also the white man's colonial pride. We can't give away this big empire, this big jewel. But what Churchill, first of all, had lost the election of 1945, though don't forget, he was no longer prime minister at the time of partition. It was Clement Attlee and the Labour government that decided to give India freedom. Churchill, had he been prime minister, would never have given India freedom. Then, as opposition MP, he was free to criticise, and he did, because he didn't want freedom to be given. So once freedom was given, he found everything to criticise about it. Now, on this particular point, he happens to be right. It was a hasty, botched, and disastrous freedom, this was a birth of a country or two countries, but it was a birth that was also an abortion, because you were literally killing this country that was being born at that point. And so, to that degree, Churchill was right that it was a disaster. But he was wrong for the reasons that he didn't want freedom at all to be given to India. He didn't want the British to leave. That was why he objected. There was no general support amongst the Muslims of India for a separate country. In fact, some of the major leaders of the Muslim community were people who passionately believed in a united India. And I'm not just talking about Maulana Abul Kalam Azad, who was the president of the Congress Party, which is, of course, committed to a united India. You had the Unionist Party in Punjab, where the Sir Sikandar Hayat Khan Tiwana and others had remained very staunch advocates of a united India. You had Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan and his brother Dr. Khan Sahib in Northwest Frontier. You had Fazlul Haq in Bengal. And in Sindh, you had a man called Allah Bakhsh, who sadly has been forgotten, who was a more popular Muslim leader than Muhammad Ali Jinnah. There is a famous story of how in 1941 or 42, there was a rally in Delhi by the Muslim League, which had enjoying power at the time. As I mentioned to you, in various provinces, calling for Pakistan. And it was well attended. And then Allah Bakhsh did a rival rally a couple of days later against partition, and he got double the crowd that Jinnah got for partition of Indian Muslims. But poor Allah Bakhsh was assassinated for his beliefs. And because he was assassinated, Sindh, for the first time, turned towards the Muslim League. So you're looking at a situation where the Muslims of India were diverted over a very short span of time from people who were very much integrated into Indian life and society into separatists. And it would not have happened. It was not inevitable. And I think anybody who argues that it was inevitable before this period, these 10 years of the war, not even 10 years, 8 years, from 1939, the resignation of the Congress governments, 42, the Quit India Movement and the jailing of the Congress leaders, the ascent of the Muslim League to power in the various provinces vacated by the Congress, the growth of the Muslim League because of the opportunities of patronage and pelf, the overt support of the British rulers and government for the Muslim League, and then the elections of 46. Until all of these things could have fallen into place, they could not and would not have been partitioned. It never was that popular a demand. And so what is shocking is that a few years, at the end of a 200-year rule, a few years were enough to completely tarnish the legacy of the British. Anything they wanted to talk about, they like to claim credit for uniting India, which, as I said, others would have done if it were not for them. But even that, they ended up tarnishing it by actually dividing India when they left. It was a shameful, shameful Brexit.
Shashi, there's another argument, another theory that is being discussed on the internet, that Pakistan was created as a buffer state to counter India's growing ties with Soviet Union and its strategic access in the Indian Ocean with lots of Western backing. Is there any merit in that?
Basically, what happened was Churchill had actually drawn up a map that looks very much like the map of 1947 earlier. Not because he was planning to leave India, but he said, if at all we are obliged to leave, we must create a state that would be pro-Western, that would essentially be a vassal state for the West. And that, he said, would have to be from the Muslim-majority areas of the Northwest, because those are the people we can rely on. These Hindus are not entirely reliable. The Congress Party is too left-wing. They're pro-socialist. They might succumb to the lure of communism, all of this. And so there was this train of thinking. As I said, Churchill did not want to leave India. But if it ever became inevitable, partition was part of their plan. And Pakistan was designed to be a Western vassal state. There have been subsequent studies of the role played not only by the British in partition, but by the subsequent role of the Western powers at the United Nations Security Council after partition and in the years after to consolidate and strengthen Pakistan. Then when the Cold War began, Pakistan became a member of the two Asian counterparts of NATO, that is CENTO and CETO. CENTO because of West Pakistan, CETO because of East Pakistan. All this was created very much because they wanted Pakistan to be an ally in the Cold War. And Pakistan benefited. They were given lots and lots of money, lots of weapons, lots of help, which in turn was used against India. And that's what forced India to look for assistance on the other side of the divide and to go, for example, for many more Soviet arms and so on.
Now, partition was one of the worst traumas in South Asian histories. After decades of pain, do projects like Dastan or the 1947 Partition Archives, do they help in closure or healing per se?
I think they're more about what we talked about the other day, about the act of don't forget. Because frankly, the trauma was experienced by a generation that is now passing on. I mean, let's face it. How many people were adults in 1947 who are still alive today? Practically no one. Now the survivors are children who remember the trauma of their parents and grandparents that they were told. There are now attempts by this generation to preserve some of those memories before even those are irretrievably lost. So you've got the Partition Museum in Amritsar. There is a Partition Museum in Delhi that's come up. You've also got Project Dastan, this virtual reality thing where you can go using modern technology and satellites and go and see your old home before partition and so on. Some of these things that are happening are ways of keeping alive a memory. But let's face it, Runjun, I've got to be very honest with you. 77 years of separation mean that these things will mean less and less with each succeeding generation. And when you think of the fact that today Pakistanis have had three generations of being told that they cannot live with Hindus, they have nothing to do with Hindus, they don't understand anything to do with Hinduism and Hindu faith and so on, when even those things in their culture that were derived from Hindu traditions are being denied to them. When you've had three generations growing up with this kind of indoctrination, will they feel the same affinity to India that this earlier generation felt? I find it difficult to understand. I can tell you, I went to Pakistan many years ago when I was at the UN, and I was taken to a museum called Lok Virsa. Lok Virsa was about the Virasat, the heritage of the Pakistani people. And they had different rooms showing the influence of Samarkand, the influence of Uzbekistan, the influence of Turkey, the influence of Persia. And I kept wandering and looking for the room with the influence of India. There wasn't one. There is this total denial that they ever were part of India, had anything to do with India. That's the kind of thing they're trying to inculcate in the people.
There are moving stories of, say, siblings reuniting at Kartarpur Sahib. Then this is after decades. There are heartfelt messages from Amritsar's Partition Museum. Partition, it was a line drawn on the map, but was it really on the hearts as well?
Not of those of that generation, no. I knew many people from that generation who still thought of Lahore or Karachi as home, even if they were living in Delhi. I know people who managed to visit their old homes and were touched. Almost everyone that I spoke to had had this experience, was welcomed very warmly by the new inhabitants. And in one rather surprising and moving story, a person told me how he went to his old home. It was actually his parents' home. He'd been a child there. And the person not only welcomed him in, but he said, let me show you something. And he took this person, this Hindu Indian, to a closed cupboard and opened it. And inside were the murtis that the family had done puja with. He said, we did not destroy what you worshipped. We kept it locked because it's not our gods. It's not our thing. But it is there for you. And if you want, you can have it. Now, this was a very moving thing for him, because he never expected that. Remember, these people fled their homes at no notice whatsoever, leaving pretty much everything behind. Photographs, memories, books, drawings, albums, everything. Some people just took fragments with them, which somehow have survived. There's a very, very moving set of these sort of artifacts that people came back with. But what they left behind often lingered longer in the memories, because these were things they would never see again. So those who could go back and see them have found this very, very moving. And I will say, ultimately, the hatred of partition has long since disappeared from the hearts of most people. But they get stoked up again when war, terrorism, and this kind of horror comes up. And there was a time, I would say, as late as the early 70s, when there was still a generation of Pakistanis who were willing to say partition was a mistake. Today, I don't think we'll find any. It's just been too long, too many decades of indoctrination. I remember in 70, what would it have been, 75, so 4 years after the 71 war, I was flying to Europe or somewhere, and for some reason, the flight had to transit through Karachi airport. So I was at the airport. I had no visa to enter Pakistan anyway. But I was just going around the shops and seeing things. And one guy came up to me. I don't know why he thought that maybe I wasn't Pakistani. He started chatting when he discovered I was Indian. He said, what a big mistake this was. You know, in 71, we should have just finished this whole thing and got together as one country again. In Pakistan, youngish man, somebody must have been born. At that point, I would say not much before partition. And I thought, wow, are there people in Pakistan who think like this? But I also realize when I next was actually able to make a proper visit to Pakistan, which was 30 years after that, that that sentiment is now no longer present. And I think in India, too, there are too many people who feel, even those who used to be advocates of Akhand Bharat, you know, reuniting the whole of India, they're beginning to say, but it'll be too much of a headache. Too many of these people are irremediably opposed to the idea of living with us. We may as well be better off keeping them apart. So you've got this kind of separation in the hearts, in the minds. And, you know, just as colonialism affected the minds of people, partition has also affected the minds of people.
To healing of the fault lines then, Dr. Shashi Tharoor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ranju.
Partition shattered millions of lives. Its scars run deep across generations. Just confronting that pain is not enough. It's our collective responsibility to learn from that brutal chapter of our history and never repeat it again.